petrol cans explode and fire rains down upon the room. I open my mouth to call to Emmeline that the baby is safe, but the first breath I draw in is nothing but heat, and I choke. I hop over fire, step around it, dodge the fire that falls on me from above, brush fire away with my hands, beat out the fire that grows in my clothes. When I reach the sisters, I cannot see them, but reach blindly through the smoke. My touch startles them, and they draw apart instantly. There is a moment when I see Emmeline, see her clearly, and she sees me. I grip her hand and pull her, through the flames, through the fire, and we reach the door. But when she realizes what I am doing, leading her away from the fire to safety, she stops. I tug at her. "He's safe!" My words come in a croak, but they are clear enough. Why doesn't she understand? I try again. "The baby! I have saved him!" Surely she has heard me. Inexplicably, she resists my tug, and her hand slips from mine. Where is she? I can see only blackness. I stumble forward into the flames, collide with her form, grasp her, and pull. Still she won't stay with me. Turns once more into the room. Why? She is bound to her sister. She is bound. Blind, and with my lungs burning, I follow her into the smoke. I will break the bond. Eyes closed against the heat, I plunge into the library, arms ahead of me searching. When my hands reach her in the smoke, I do not let her go. I will not have her die. I will save her. And though she resists, I drag her ferociously to the door and out of it. The door is made of oak. It is heavy. It doesn't burn easily. I push it shut behind us, and the latch engages. Beside me, she steps forward, about to open it again. It is something stronger than fire that pulls her into that room. The key that sits in the lock, unused since the days of Hester, is hot. It burns my palm as I turn it. Nothing else hurts me that night, but the key sears my palm, and I smell my flesh as it chars. Emmeline puts out a hand to clutch the key and open it again. The metal burns her, and as she feels the shock of it, I pull her hand away. A great cry fills my head. Is it human, or is it the sound of the fire itself? I don't even know whether it was coming from inside the room or outside with me. From a guttural start, it gathers strength as it rises, reaches a shrill peak of intensity, and when I think it must be at the end of its breath, it continues, impossibly low, impossibly long, a boundless sound that fills the world and engulfs it and contains it. And then the sound is gone, and there is only the roar of the fire. Outdoors. Rain. The grass is soaked. We sink to the ground. We roll on the wet grass to damp our smouldering clothes and hair, feel the cool wet on our scorched flesh. On our backs we rest there, flat against the earth. I open my mouth and drink the rain. It falls on my face, cools my eyes, and I can see again. Never has there been a sky like it. Deep indigo, with fast-moving slate-black clouds, the rain coming down in blade edges of silver, and every so often a plume, a spray of bright orange from the house, a fountain of fire. A bolt of lightning cracks the sky in two, then again and again. The baby. I must tell Emmeline about the baby. She will be happy that I have saved him. It will make things all right. I turn to her and open my mouth to speak. Her face, her poor, beautiful face, is black and red, all smoke and blood and fire. Her eyes, her green gaze, ravaged, unseeing, unknowing. I look at her face and cannot find my beloved in it. Emmeline? I whisper. Emmeline? She does not reply. I feel my heart die. What have I done? Have I? Is it possible that... I cannot bear to know. I cannot bear not to know. Adeline? My voice is a broken thing. But she, this person, this someone, this one or the other, this might or might not be, this darling, this monster, this... I don't know who she is, does not reply. People are coming, running up the drive, voices calling urgently in the night. I rise to a crouch and scuttle away, keeping low, hiding. They reach the girl on the grass, and when I am sure they have found her, I leave them to it. In the church, I put the satchel over my shoulder, clutching the baby in his papoose to my side, and set off. It is quiet in the woods. The rain, slowed by the canopy of leaves, falls softly on the undergrowth. The child whimpers, then sleeps. My feet carry me to a small house on the edge of the woods. I know the house. I have seen it often during my haunting years. A woman lives there alone. Spying her through the window knitting or baking, I have always thought she looks nice. And when I read about kindly grandmothers and fairy godmothers in my books, I supply them with her face. I take the baby to her. I glance in at the window, as I have before, see her in her usual place by the fire knitting, thoughtful and quiet. She is undoing her knitting, just sitting there pulling the stitches out, with the needles on the table beside her. There is a dry place in the porch for the baby. I settle him there and wait behind a tree. She opens the door, takes him up. I know when I see her expression that he will be safe with her. She looks up and around, in my direction, as if she's seen something. Have I rustled the leaves, betrayed my presence? It crosses my mind to step forward. Surely she would befriend me. I hesitate, and the wind changes direction. I smell the fire at the same moment she does. She turns away, looks to the sky, gasps at the smoke that rises over the spot where Angelfield House stands. And then puzzlement shows in her face. She holds the baby close to her nose and sniffs. The smell of fire is on him, transferred from my clothes. One more glance at the smoke, and she steps firmly back into her house and closes the door. I am alone. No name, no home, no family. I am nothing. I have nowhere to go. I have no one who belongs to me. I stare at my burned palm, but cannot feel the pain. What kind of a thing am I? Am I even alive? I could go anywhere, but I walk back to Angel Field. It is the only place I know. Emerging from the trees, I approach the scene. A fire engine. Villagers with their buckets standing back, dazed and with smoke-blackened faces, watching the professionals do battle with the flames. Women, mesmerized by smoke rising into the black sky. An ambulance. Dr. Maudsley kneeling over a figure on the grass. No one sees me. On the edge of all the activity, I stand invisible. Perhaps I really am nothing. Perhaps no one can see me at all. Perhaps I died in the fire and haven't realized it yet. Perhaps I am finally what I have always been. A ghost. Then one of the women looks in my direction. Look, she cries, pointing. She's here. And people turn, stare. One of the women runs to alert the men. They turn from the fire and look too. Thank God, someone says. I open my mouth to say, I don't know what, but I say nothing. Just stand there, making shapes with my mouth. No voice and no words. Don't try to speak. Dr. Maudsley is by my side now. I stare at the girl on the lawn. She'll survive, says the doctor. I look at the house. The flames. My books. I don't think I can bear it. I remember the page of Jane Eyre, the ball of words I saved from the pyre. I have left it behind with the baby. I begin to weep. She's in shock, says the doctor to one of the women. Keep her warm and stay with her while we put the sister in the ambulance. A woman comes to me, clucking her concern. She takes off her coat and wraps it around me tenderly, as though dressing a baby, and she murmurs, Don't worry. You'll be all right. Your sister's all right. Oh, my poor dear. They lift the girl from the grass and place her on the bed in the ambulance. Then they help me in, sit me down opposite, and they drive us to the hospital. She stares into space. Eyes open, empty. After the first moment, I don't look. The ambulance man bends over her, assures himself that she is breathing, then turns to me. What about that hand, eh? I am clutching my right hand in my left, unconscious of the pain in my mind, but my body giving the secret away. He takes my hand, and I let him unfold my fingers. A mark is burned deep into my palm. The key. That'll heal up, he tells me. Don't worry. Now, are you Adeline or are you Emmeline? He gestures to the other one. Is this Emmeline? I can't answer. Can't feel myself. Can't move. Not to worry, he said. All in good time. He gives up on making me understand him. Mutters for his own benefit. Still, we've got to call you something. Adeline, Emmeline. Emmeline, Adeline. 50-50, isn't it? It'll all come out in the wash. The hospital. Opening the ambulance doors. All noise and bustle. Voices speaking fast. The stretcher, lifted onto a trolley and wheeled away at speed. A wheelchair. Hands on my shoulders. Sit down, dear. The chair moving. A voice behind my back. Don't worry, child. We'll take care of you and your sister. You're safe now, Adeline.
Miss Winter slept. I saw the tender slackness of her open mouth, the tuft of unruly hair that didn't lay straight from her temple. And in her sleep, she seemed very, very old, and very, very young. With every breath she took, the bedclothes rose and fell over her thin shoulders, and at each sinking, the ribboned edge of the blanket brushed against her face. She seemed unaware of it, but all the same, I bent over her to fold the covers back and smooth the curl of pale hair back into place. She didn't stir. Was she really asleep, I wondered, or was this unconsciousness already? I can't say how long I watched her after that. There was a clock, but the movements of its hands were as meaningless as a map of the surface of the sea. Wave after wave of time lapped over me as I sat with my eyes closed, not sleeping, but with the vigilance of a mother for the breathing of her child. I hardly know what to say about the next thing. Is it possible that I hallucinated in my tiredness? Did I fall asleep and dream? Or did Miss Winter really speak one last time? I will give your message to your sister. I jerked my eyes open, but hers were closed. She seemed to be sleeping as deeply as before. I didn't see the wolf when he came. I didn't hear him. There was only this. A little before dawn, I became aware of a hush, and I realized that the only breathing to be heard in the room was my own. Beginnings. Snow. Miss Winter died, and the snow kept falling. When Judith came, she stood with me for a time at the window, and we watched the eerie illumination of the night sky. Then, when an alteration in the whiteness told us it was morning, she sent me to bed. I awoke at the end of the afternoon. The snow that had already deadened the telephone now reached the window ledges and drifted halfway up the doors. It separated us from the rest of the world as effectively as a prison key. Miss Winter had escaped. So had the woman Judith referred to as Emmeline, and whom I avoided naming. The rest of us, Judith, Maurice, and I, were trapped. The cat was restless. It was the snow that put him out. He didn't like the change in the appearance of his universe. He went from one windowsill to another in search of his lost world, and meowed urgently at Judith, Maurice, and me, as though its restoration was in our hands. In comparison, the loss of his mistresses was a small matter that, if he noticed it at all, left him fundamentally undisturbed. The snow had blockaded us into a sideways extension of time, and we each found our own way of enduring it. Judith, imperturbable, made vegetable soup, cleaned the kitchen cupboards out, and when she ran out of jobs, manicured her nails and did a face pack. Maurice, chafing at the confinement and the inactivity, played endless games of solitaire. But when he had to drink his tea black for lack of milk, Judith played rummy with him, to distract him from the bitterness. As for me, I spent 2 days writing up my final notes. But when that was done, I found I couldn't settle to reading. Even Sherlock Holmes couldn't reach me in the snow-locked landscape. Alone in my room, I spent an hour examining my melancholy, trying to name what I thought was a new element in it. I realized that I missed Miss Winter. So, hopeful of human company, I made my way to the kitchen. Maurice was glad to play cards with me, even though I knew only children's games. Then when Judith's nails were drying, I made the cocoa and tea with no milk, and later let Judith file and polish my own nails. In this way, we three and the cat sat out the days, locked in with our dead, and with the old year seeming to linger on past its time. On the fifth day, I allowed myself to be overcome by a vast sorrow. I'd done the washing up, and Maurice had dried while Judith played solitaire at the table. We were all glad of a change. And when the washing up was done, I took myself away from their company to the drawing room. The window looked out onto the part of the garden that was in the lee of the house. Here the snow didn't drift so high. I opened a window, climbed out into the whiteness, and walked across the snow. All the grief I had kept at bay for years by means of books and bookcases approached me now. On a bench sheltered by a tall hedge of yew, I abandoned myself to a sorrow that was wide and deep as the snow itself, and as untainted. I cried for Miss Winter, for her ghost, for Adeline and Emmeline, for my sister, my mother, and my father. Mostly, and most terribly, I cried for myself. My grief was that of the infant, newly severed from her other half, of the child bent over an old tin, making sudden, shocking sense of a few pieces of paper, and of a grown woman, sitting crying on a bench in the hallucinatory light and silence of the snow. When I came to myself, Dr. Clifton was there. He put an arm around me.
"I know," he said. "I know."
He didn't know, of course. Not really. And yet that was what he said, and I was soothed to hear it, for I knew what he meant. We all have our sorrows, and although the exact delineaments, weight, and dimensions of grief are different for everyone, the colour of grief is common to us all. "I know," he said, because he was human, and therefore, in a way, he did. He led me inside, to warmth.
"Oh, dear," said Judith. "Shall I bring cocoa?"
"With a touch of brandy in it, I think," he said.
Maurice pulled out a chair for me and began to stoke the fire. I sipped the cocoa slowly. There was milk. The doctor had brought it when he came with the farmer on the tractor. Judith tucked a shawl around me, then started peeling potatoes for dinner. She and Maurice and the doctor made the occasional comment, what we could have for supper, whether the snow was lighter now, how long it would be before the telephone line was restored. And in making them, took it upon themselves to start the laborious process of cranking up life again, after death had stopped us all in its tracks. Little by little, the comments melded together and became a conversation. I listened to their voices, and after a time, joined in. Happy birthday. I went home to the bookshop. Miss Winter is dead, I told my father.
And you? How are you? He asked.
Alive. He smiled. Tell me about Mum, I said to him. Why is she the way she is? He told me.
She was very ill when you were born. She never saw you before you were taken away. She never saw your sister. She nearly died. By the time she came round, your operation had already taken place, and your sister...
My sister had died.
Yes. There was no knowing how it would go with you. I went from her bedside to yours. I thought I was going to lose all three of you. I prayed to every god I had ever heard of to save you. And my prayers were answered. In part. You survived. Your mother never really came back. There was one other thing I needed to know. Why didn't you tell me about being a twin? The face he turned to me was devastated. He swallowed, and when he spoke, his voice was hoarse.
The story of your birth is a sad one. Your mother thought it too heavy for a child to bear. At least that's what your mother said. I would have borne it for you, Margaret, if I could. I would have done anything to spare you.
We sat in silence. I thought of all the other questions I might have asked, but now that the moment had come, I didn't need to. I reached for my father's hand at the same moment as he reached for mine. I attended 3 funerals in as many days. Miss Winter's mourners were many. The nation grieved for its favourite storyteller, and thousands of readers turned out to pay their respects. I came away as soon as I could, having said my goodbyes already. The second was a quiet affair. There were only Judith, Maurice, the doctor, and me to mourn the woman referred to throughout the service as Emmeline. Afterward, we said brief farewells and parted. The third was lonelier still. In a crematorium in Banbury, I was the only person in attendance when a bland-faced clergyman oversaw the passing into God's hands of a set of bones, identity unknown. Into God's hands, except that it was me who collected the urn later, on behalf of the Angelfield family. There were snowdrops in Angelfield, at least the first signs of them, boring their way through the frozen ground and showing their points green and fresh above the snow. As I stood up, I heard a sound. It was Aurelius, arriving at the lych gate. Snow had settled on his shoulders, and he was carrying flowers. Aurelius! How could he have grown so sad? So pale. You've changed, I said.
I've worn myself out on a wild goose chase.
His eyes, always mild, had lightened to the same washed-out blue as the January sky. You could see straight through their transparency to his disappointed heart.
All my life, I've wanted to find my family. I wanted to know who I was. And lately, I've felt hopeful. I thought there might be some chance of restoration. Now I fear I was mistaken.
We walked along the grass path between the graves and cleared the snow from the bench and sat down before more could fall. Aurelius delved into his pocket and unwrapped two pieces of cake. Absently, he handed one to me and dug his teeth into the other.
"Is that what you have for me?" he asked, looking at the casket. "Is that the rest of my story?"
I handed him the casket.
"Isn't it light? Light as air. And yet..."
His hand veered to his heart. He sought a gesture to show how heavy his heart was. Not finding it, he put down the casket and took another bite of cake. When he'd finished the last morsel, he spoke.
"If she was my mother, why was I not with her? Why did I not die with her, in this place? Why would she take me away to Mrs. Love's house and then come back here to a house on fire? Why? It doesn't make sense."
I followed him as he stepped off the central path and made his way into the maze of narrow borders between the graves. He stopped at a grave I had looked at before and laid down his flowers. The stone was a simple one. Joan Mary Love. Never forgotten. Poor Aurelius. He was so very weary. He hardly seemed to notice as I slipped my arm through his. But then he turned to face me fully.
"Perhaps it's better not to have a story at all, rather than have one that keeps changing. I've spent my whole life chasing after my story and never quite catching it. Running after my story when I had Mrs. Love, all along. She loved me. You know,
I never doubted it. She'd been a good mother to him. Better than either of the twins could have been. Perhaps it's better not to know," I suggested. He looked from the gravestone to the white sky.
"Do you think so?"
"No."
"Then why suggest it?"
I slid my arm from his and tucked my cold hands under the arms of my coat. "It's what my mother would say. She thinks a weightless story is better than one that's too heavy."
"So, my story is a heavy one."
I said nothing. And when the silence grew long, I told him not his story, but my own. "I had a sister," I began. "A twin." He turned to face me. His shoulders were solid and wide against the sky, and he listened gravely to the story I poured out to him. "We were joined, here." And I brushed my hand down my left side. "She couldn't live without me. She needed my heart to beat for her. But I couldn't live with her. She was draining my strength. They separated us. And she died." My other hand joined the first over my scar, and I pressed hard. "My mother never told me. She thought it was better for me not to know."
"A weightless story."
"Yes."
"But you do know."
I pressed harder. I found out by accident.
"I'm sorry," he said.
I felt my hands taken by his, and he enclosed both of them into one great fist. Then with his other arm he drew me to him. Through layers of coats I felt the softness of his belly, and a rush of noise came to my ear. "It's the beating of his heart," I thought. "A human heart. By my side." So this is what it's like. I listened. Then we drew apart.
And is it better to know? He asked me.
I can't tell you. But once you know, it's impossible to go back.
And you know my story?
Yes.
My true story?
Yes. He barely hesitated, just took a breath and seemed to grow a little bigger.
You had better tell me, then, he said.
I told, and while I told, we walked, and when I finished telling, we were standing at the place where the snowdrops were pointing through the whiteness of the snow. With the casket in his hands, Aurelius hesitated.
I have a feeling this is against the rules.
I thought it was too. But what else can we do?
The rules don't work for this case, do they?
Nothing else would be right.
Come on, then.
We used the cake knife to gouge a hollow in the frozen earth above the coffin of the woman I knew as Emmeline. Aurelius tipped the ashes into it, and we replaced the earth to cover them. Aurelius pressed down with all his weight, and then we rearranged the flowers to hide the disturbance.
It will level out with the melting of the snow, he said,
and he brushed the snow from his trouser legs. Aurelius, there's more to your story. I led him to another part of the churchyard. You know about your mother now, but you had a father, too. I indicated Ambrose's gravestone. The A and the S on the piece of paper you showed me. It was his name. His bag, too. It was used for carrying game. That explains the feather. I paused. It was a lot for Aurelius to take in. When after a long moment he nodded, I went on. He was a good man. You are very like him. Aurelius stared, dazed, more knowledge, more loss.
He's dead. I see.
That's not all, I said softly. He turned his eyes slowly to mine, and I read in them the fear that there was to be no end to the story of his abandonment. I took his hand. I smiled at him. After you were born, Ambrose married. He had another child. It took a moment for him to realize what it meant. And when he did, a jolt of excitement brought his frame to life.
You mean, I have... And she... He... She...
Yes, a sister. The smile grew broad on his face. I went on. And she has her own children in turn. A boy and a girl.
A niece? And a nephew?
I took his hands into mine to stop them shaking. A family, Aurelius. Your family. You know them already. And they're expecting you. I could hardly keep up with him as we passed through the lych gate and strode down the avenue to the white gatehouse. Aurelius never looked back. Only at the gatehouse did we pause, and that was because of me. Aurelius, I almost forgot to give you this. He took the white envelope and opened it, distracted by joy. He drew out the card and gave me a look.
What? Not really.
Yes, really.
Today?
Today. Something possessed me at that moment. I did something I have never done in my life before and never expected to do either. I opened my mouth and shouted at the top of my voice, Happy birthday! I must have been a bit mad. In any case, I felt embarrassed. Not that Aurelius cared. He was standing motionless, arms stretched out on either side of him, eyes closed, and face turned skyward. All the happiness in the world was falling on him with the snow. In Karin's garden, the snow bore the prints of chase games, small footprints and smaller ones following one another in broad circles. The children were nowhere to be seen, but as we got nearer, we heard their voices coming from the niche in the yew tree.
"Let's play Snow White."
"That's a girl's story."
"What story do you want to play?"
"A story about rockets."
"I don't want to be a rocket. Let's be boats."
"We were boats yesterday."
Hearing the latch of the gate, they peered out of the tree, and with their hoods hiding their hair, you could hardly tell brother from sister.
"It's the cake man."
Karin stepped out of the house and came across the lawn. "Shall I tell you who this is?" she asked the children as she smiled shyly at Aurelius.
"This is your uncle."
Aurelius looked from Karin to the children and back to Karin, his eyes scarcely big enough to take in everything he wanted to. He was lost for words, but Karin reached out a tentative hand, and he took it in his.
"It's all a bit," he began.
"Isn't it?" she agreed. "But we'll get used to it, won't we?" He nodded. The children were staring with curiosity at the adult scene. "What are you playing?" Karin asked, to distract them.
"We don't know,"
the girl said.
"We can't decide," said her brother.
"Do you know any stories?"
Emma asked Aurelius.
"Only one," he told her.
"Only one?"
She was astounded.
"Has it got any frogs in it?"
"No."
"Dinosaurs?"
"No."
"Secret passages?"
"No."
The children looked at each other. It wasn't much of a story, clearly.
"We know loads of stories," Tom said.
"Loads," she echoed dreamily. "Princesses, frogs, magic castles, fairy godmothers, caterpillars, rabbits, elephants, all sorts of animals, all sorts."
They fell into silence, absorbed in shared contemplation of countless different worlds. Aurelius watched them as though they were a miracle. Then they returned to the real world.
"Millions of stories," the boy said.
"Shall I tell you a story?"
the girl asked. I thought perhaps Aurelius had had enough stories for one day, but he nodded his head. She picked up an imaginary object and placed it in the palm of her right hand. With her left, she mimed the opening of a book cover. She glanced up to be sure she had the full attention of her companions. Then her eyes returned to the book in her hand, and she began.
"Once upon a time..."
Karin and Tom and Aurelius. Three sets of eyes all resting on Emma and her storytelling. They would be all right together. Unnoticed, I stepped back from the gate and slipped away along the street. The 13th Tale. I will not publish the biography of Vida Winter. The world may well be agog for the story, but it's not mine to tell. Adeline and Emmeline, the fire and the ghost, these are stories that belong to Aurelius now. The graves in the churchyard are his. So is the birthday that he can mark as he chooses. The truth is heavy enough without the additional weight of the world's scrutiny on his shoulders. Left to their own devices, he and Karin can turn the page, start afresh. But time passes. One day Aurelius will be no more. One day Karin, too, will leave this world. The children, Tom and Emma, are already more distant from the events I've told here than their uncle. With the help of their mother, they've begun to forge their own stories, stories that are strong and solid and true. The day will come when Isabel and Charlie, Adeline and Emmeline, the Mrs. and John the Dig, the girl without a name, will be so far in the past that their old bones will have no power to cause fear or pain. They will be nothing but an old story, unable to do any harm to anyone. And when that day comes, I will be old myself by then, I shall give Tom and Emma this document, to read, and if they choose, to publish. I hope that they will publish, for until they do, the spirit of that ghost child will haunt me. She will roam in my thoughts, linger in my dreams, my memory her only playground. It is not much, this posthumous life of hers, but it is not oblivion. It will be enough until the day when Tom and Emma release this manuscript, and she will be able to exist more fully after death than she ever lived before it. And so the story of the ghost girl is not to be published for many years, if at all. That does not mean, however, that I have nothing to give the world immediately to satisfy its curiosity about Vida Winter. For there is something. At the end of my last meeting with Mr. Lomax, I was about to leave when he stopped me. "Just one more thing." And he opened his desk and took out an envelope. I had that envelope with me when I slipped unremarked out of Karin's garden and turned my steps back toward the lodge gate. The ground for the new hotel had been flattened, and when I tried to remember the old house, I could find only photographs in my memory. But then it came to me how it always seemed to face the wrong way. It had been twisted. The new building was going to be much better. It would face straight toward you. I diverged from the gravel pathway to cross the snow-covered lawn toward the old deer park and the woods. The dark branches were heavy with snow, which sometimes fell in soft swaths at my passing. I came at last to the vantage point on the slope. You can see everything from there. The church and its graveyard, the wreaths of flowers bright against the snow, the lodge gate, chalk-white against the blue sky, the coach-house, denuded of its shroud of thorns. Only the house had gone, and it had gone completely. The men in their yellow hats had reduced the past to a blank page. We had reached tipping point. It was no longer possible to call it a demolition site. Tomorrow, today, perhaps, the workers would return and it would become a construction site. The past demolished, it was time for them to start building the future. I took the envelope from my bag. I had been waiting for the right time, the right place. The letters on the envelope were curiously misformed. The uneven strokes either faded into nothing or else were engraved into the paper. There was no sense of flow. Each letter gave the impression of having been completed individually, at great cost, the next undertaken as a new and daunting enterprise. It was like the hand of a child or a very old person. It was addressed to Miss Margaret Lee. I slit open the flap. I drew out the contents, and I sat on a felled tree to read it, because I never read standing up. Dear Margaret, here is the piece I told you about. I have tried to finish it, and find that I cannot. And so this story that the world has made so much fuss about must do as it is. It is a flimsy thing. Something of nothing. Do with it what you will. As for titles, the one that springs to my mind is Cinderella's Child. But I know quite enough about readers to understand that whatever I might choose to call it, it will only ever go by one title in the world. And it won't be mine. There was no signature. No name. But there was a story. It was the story of Cinderella, like I've never read it before, laconic, hard, and angry. Miss Winter's sentences were shards of glass, brilliant and lethal. Picture this, the story begins. A boy and a girl, one rich, one poor. Most often it's the girl who's got no gold, and that's how it is in the story I'm telling. There didn't have to be a ball. A walk in the woods was enough for these two to stumble into each other's paths. Once upon the time there was a fairy godmother, but the rest of the time there was none. This story is about one of those other times. Our girl's pumpkin is just a pumpkin, and she crawls home after midnight, blood on her petticoats, violated. There will be no footman at the door with moleskin slippers tomorrow. She knows that already. She's not stupid. She is pregnant, though. In the rest of the story, Cinderella gives birth to a girl, raises her in poverty and filth, abandons her after a few years in the grounds of the house owned by her violator. The story ends abruptly. Halfway along the path in the garden she has never been to before, cold and hungry, the child suddenly realizes she is alone. Behind her is the garden door that leads into the forest. It remains ajar. Is her mother behind it still? Ahead of her is a shed that to her child's mind has the look of a little house, a place she might shelter. Who knows? There might even be something to eat. The garden door or the little house? Door or house? The child hesitates. She hesitates. And the story ends there. Miss Winter's earliest memory? Or just a story? The story invented by an imaginative child to fill the space where her mother ought to have been? The 13th tale. The final. The famous. The unfinished story. I read the story and grieved. Gradually my thoughts turned away from Miss Winter and to myself. She might not be perfect, but at least I had a mother. Was it too late to make something of ourselves? But that was another story. I put the envelope in my bag, stood up and brushed the bark dust from my trousers before heading back to the road. I was engaged to write the story of Miss Winter's life, and I have done it. There is really nothing more I need do in order to fulfill the terms of the contract. One copy of this document is to be deposited with Mr. Lomax, who will store it in a bank vault and then arrange for a large amount of money to be paid to me. Apparently he doesn't even have to check that the pages I give him are not blank. She trusted you, he told me. Clearly she did trust me. Her intentions in the contract that I never read or signed are quite unmistakable. She wanted to tell me the story before she died. She wanted me to make a record of it. What I did with it after that was my business. I've told the solicitor about my intentions regarding Tom and Emma, and we've made an appointment to formalize my wishes in a will, just in case. And that ought to be the end of it. But I don't feel I'm quite done. I don't know who or how many people will eventually read this, but no matter how few they are, no matter how distant in time from this moment, I feel a responsibility toward them. And although I've told them all there is to know about Adeline and Emmeline and the ghost child, I realize that for some that will not be quite enough. I know what it is like to finish a book and find oneself wondering a day or a week later what happened to the butcher or who got the diamonds, or whether or not the dowager was ever reconciled with her niece. I can imagine readers pondering what became of Judith and Maurice, whether anyone kept up the glorious garden, who came to live in the house. And so, in case you are wondering, let me tell you. Judith and Maurice stayed on. The house was not sold. Provision had been made in Miss Winter's will for the house and garden to be converted into a kind of literary museum. Of course, it is the garden that has real value. An unsuspected gem, an early horticultural review has called it. But Miss Winter realized that it was her reputation for storytelling, more than her gardening skill, that would draw the crowds. And so they are to be tours of the rooms, a tea shop, and a bookshop. Coaches that bring tourists to the Bronte Museum can come afterward to Vida Winter's secret garden. Judith will continue as housekeeper, and Maurice as head gardener. Their first job, before the conversion can begin, is to clear Emmeline's rooms. These will not be visited, for there will be nothing to see. And Hester. Now this will surprise you. It certainly surprised me. I had a letter from Emmanuel Drake. To tell you the truth, I'd forgotten all about him. Slowly and methodically he continued his searches, and against all odds, late in the day, he found her. It was the Italian connection that threw me off track, his letter explained. When your governess had gone the other way entirely. To America. For 3 years, Hester had worked as clerical assistant to an academic neurologist, and when the time was up, guess who came to join her? Dr. Maudsley. His wife died, nothing more sinister than the flu, I did check. And within days of the funeral, he was on the boat. It was love. They are both deceased now, but after a long and happy life together. They had 4 children, one of whom has written to me, and I have sent the original of his mother's diary to him to keep. I doubt he will be able to make out much more than 1 word in 10. If he asks me for elucidation, I will tell him that his mother knew his father here in England during the time of his father's first marriage. But if he doesn't ask, I will keep my silence. In his letter to me, he enclosed a list of his parents' joint publications. They researched and wrote dozens of highly regarded articles. None on twins. I think they knew when to call it a day. And published them jointly. Dr. E. and Mrs. H. J. Maudsley. H. J.? Hester had a middle name. Josephine. What else will you want to know? Who looked after the cat? Well, Shadow came to live with me, at the bookshop. He sits on the shelves, anywhere he can find a space between the books. And when customers come across him there, he returns their stares with placid equanimity. From time to time he will sit in the window, but not for long. He's baffled by the street, the vehicles, the passers-by, the buildings opposite. I have shown him the shortcut via the alley to the river, but he scorns to use it. "What do you expect?" my father says. "A river is no use to a Yorkshire cat. It's the moors he's looking for." I think he's right. Full of expectation, Shadow jumps up to the window, looks out, then turns on me a long, disappointed stare. I don't like to think that he is homesick. Dr. Clifton came to my father's shop. He happened to be visiting the town, he said, and remembering that my father had a bookshop here, he thought it worthwhile to call in, though it was something of a long shot, to see if we had a particular volume on 18th-century medicine he was interested in. As it happened, we did have one, and he and my father chatted amiably about it at length, until well after closing time. To make up for keeping us so late, he invited us out for a meal. It was very pleasant, and since he was still in town for another night, my father invited him the next evening for a meal with the family. In the kitchen, my mother told me he was a very nice man, Margaret. Very nice. The next afternoon was his last. We went for a walk by the river, but this time it was just the two of us, father being too busy writing letters to be able to accompany us. I told him the story of the ghost of Angelfield. He listened closely, and when I'd finished, we continued to walk, slowly and in silence. "I remember seeing that treasure box," he said eventually. "How did it come to escape the fire?" I stopped in my tracks, wondering. "You know?" I never thought to ask.
You'll never know now, will you?
He took my arm and we walked on. Anyway, returning to my subject, which is Shadow and his homesickness, when Dr. Clifton visited my father's shop and saw the cat's sadness, he proposed to give Shadow a home with him. Shadow would be very happy back in Yorkshire, I have no doubt. But this offer, kind as it is, has plunged me into a state of painful perplexity, for I'm not sure I can bear to be parted from him. He, I am sure, would bear my absence with the same composure with which he accepts Miss Winter's disappearance, for he is a cat. But being human, I've grown fond of him, and would prefer, if at all possible, to keep him near me. In a letter I betrayed some of these thoughts to Dr. Clifton. He replies that perhaps we might both go and stay, Shadow and I, for a holiday. He invites us for a month in the spring. Anything, he says, may happen in a month. And by the end of it, he thinks it possible that we may have thought of some way out of the dilemma that suits us all. I cannot help but think Shadow will get his happy ending yet. And that is all. Postscriptum. Or nearly all. One thinks something is finished, and then suddenly it isn't. Quite. I've had a visitor. It was Shadow who was first to notice. I was humming as I packed for our holiday, suitcase open on the bed. Shadow was stepping in and out of it, toying with the idea of making himself a nest on my socks and cardigans, when suddenly he stopped, all intent, and stared toward the door behind me. She came not as a golden angel, nor as the cloaked spectre of death. She was like me, a tallish, thin, brown-haired woman you would not notice if she passed you in the street. There were 100, 1,000 things I thought I would want to ask her, but I was so overcome I could hardly even speak her name. She stepped toward me, put her arms around me, and pressed me to her side. "Moira," I managed to whisper. "I was beginning to think you weren't real." But she was real. Her cheek against mine, her arm across my shoulders, my hand at her waist. Scar to scar we touched, and all my questions faded as I felt her blood flow with mine, her heart beat with mine. It was a moment of wonderment, great and calm, and I knew that I remembered this feeling. It had been locked in me, closed away, and now she had come and released it. This blissful circuitry, this oneness that had once been ordinary and was today, now that I had recovered it, miraculous. She came, and we were together. I understood that she had come to say goodbye, that next time we met, it would be me who went to her. But this next meeting wouldn't be for a very long time. There was no rush. She could wait, and so could I. I felt the touch of her fingers on my face as I brushed away her tears. Then, in joy, our fingers found each other and entwined. Her breath on my cheek, her face in my hair. I buried my nose in the crook of her neck and inhaled her sweetness. Such joy. No matter that she couldn't stay. She had come. She had come. I'm not sure how or when she left. I simply realized that she was no longer there. I sat on the bed, quite calm, quite happy. I felt the curious sensation of my blood rerouting itself, of my heart recalibrating its beat for me alone. Touching my scar, she had brought it alive. Now, gradually, it cooled until it felt no different from the rest of my body. She had come, and she had gone. I would not see her again this side of the grave. My life was my own. In the suitcase, Shadow was asleep. I put out my hand to stroke him. He opened a cool green eye, regarded me for a moment, then closed it again.
The 13th Tale was written by Diane Setterfield and read by Bianca Amato as Margaret Lee and Jill Tanner as Vida Winter. This recording was directed by Ethan Gamache and produced by Andy Paris in the studios of Recorded Books, LLC. Editing and post-production were done at Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The associate producer was Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The 13th Tale is available in hardcover from Atria.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.